I'm Craig Freeman, and welcome to Weekend Let's Hear It. On the ever-evolving and metaphorical Mount Rushmore of jazz, you'll find the pianist Thelonious Monk. Born in 1917, Monk was one of the originators of bebop and is known for taking a decidedly different path than his contemporaries at the time. His style was regarded as jagged and dissonant, and many failed to see the reverence for the great jazz musicians that preceded him. Eventually, he too became revered as one of the greats. My guest today counts himself among one of those many people that appreciate and revere Monk. His name is Dan Willenberg. He's a pianist and educator in the area, and he's joining us today to talk about Monk and share some of his music with us. Thanks for coming in today, Dan.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's great having you here. I think we'll start first with you, since you're going to be playing a lot of this music. If you could give us a little bit of your background, why you picked piano, how long you've been playing, what you're doing these days.
Cool. So when I was around 4 years old, my older sister started taking piano lessons, and all of a sudden we had a piano in our house, and there was music in our house all the time. And I was really fascinated by what she was doing, you know, hearing those little tiny songs that she would be playing. I just thought it was amazing, like most kids do. And eventually I bugged my parents to let me take lessons, and they told me I had to wait until I was 5. So I never looked back pretty much after that. And, you know, it's kind of, she stopped playing when she was in maybe middle school or high school, and I just kept going. And next thing you know, here I am.
Here you are.
Basically surrounded by pianos all day, every day. And I love it. And I was mostly a classical person. Pretty much my entire musical upbringing was only playing classical music. And I studied music education and piano performance at Albion College with Dr. David Abbott, who's an incredible classical musician. I mean, phenomenal. And I was so lucky to have him as a educator. But when I was maybe a junior in college, I got really interested in the idea of improvisation. I'd never really made a note up of music in my life on the piano because it was just never my thing. I was always playing Beethoven or Chopin or Liszt or Bach, you know. And so unfortunately, when I was in school at Albion, they didn't have a jazz program. They just had a jazz band that I wasn't in because I didn't know what I was doing. But I kind of took it upon myself to kind of explore this new world of playing the piano and the instrument that I loved so much. And that was kind of when I became introduced to Thelonious Monk and the idea of just raw, unashamed emotion coming through an instrument with no, I don't want to say complete disregard for what the audience or what the public, you know, thinks, but that was what kind of Monk was all about. He was dedicated to his work. Most people would kind of see him, maybe write him off as like this kind of quirky, kind of weird guy who just made these weird sounds in the piano. I mean, he was a visionary, not just in the world of bebop, but in the world of modern music. And I really became fascinated by that. So long story short, I ended up working in a practice room by myself without any instruction or formal anything for about 2 years and finished my music education degree. And that's when I moved to Kalamazoo because for whatever reason, Steve Zagree, when he was here, he accepted me into the program at Western as a grad student. And I was like, oh my gosh, now I'm, you know, next thing you know, I'm like studying with Grammy nominated pianists and I'm just like surrounded by all these incredible musicians. And then we have the Gilmore Festival. And I walked out of my apartment and Brad Meldow was like playing like 2 blocks away. It was incredible. I had no idea that, you know, Kalamazoo was so amazing, but I've just been spending the last few years after I finished my master's degree, and then I did, I'm actually still working on a performer's diploma right now from Western, and it's just been a phenomenal, like, kind of twist and turn of life of just going from one side of the, you know, I don't want to say the musical spectrum, because to me, classical and jazz don't, there's no separation between the two. It's just music, and it's just kind of in a different vein, you know. Yeah. The world of improvising is something that once it grabs you, you know, and you explore the possibilities, you never want to stop exploring that. And Monk is kind of, he's a vehicle for me to do that, you know.
It's so cool the way that happened. It seems very, very natural. And you started in a completely different realm, and your sheer curiosity is what led you to where you're at now.
Yeah, I had a couple of good friends at Albion that were, well, pretty much just one. But he'd been playing jazz like his whole life, and so him and I would get together, and he would just be like, "Okay, we're gonna play blues," and I was like, "What's a blues?" You know, and so he would like show me some chords and show me a scale, and I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but we kind of just started jamming together, and I don't know if it was necessarily natural, but I tried to make it become as natural as possible, I guess.
Very cool. So leading to where you're at now, what's your first Monk tune that you heard that opened your eyes to all those wonderful things you said about his unique style and the dissonance, the angular kind of style that you were talking about? Or maybe there wasn't a defining moment when you heard a tune.
Yeah, they were all pretty defining. I think, I'll be honest, I'm hard-pressed to remember, but I want to say that Round Midnight was the first tune that I ever became exposed to. His solo piano recordings of that tune are just absolutely incredible, hearing what he does. And I, you know, it was daunting at first, because you look at a Monk tune and you see, okay, like all these normal chords and, you know, these seemingly, I mean, they're done at just the right time. Like for him, it was so much about timing and knowing when to put something that sounded, you know, odd or off or something to the normal ear. I think that that's kind of what drew me to him a little bit. So I would probably say Round Midnight, because that the timing of that, of all these little things that he does, all these little inner lines and everything that he plays, really just, it still blows me away. Mm. Even though I can listen to it all day, I'm still just, I never know what he's going to do next.
Yeah, very cool.
Well, I guess since we were just talking about it, I'll do Round Midnight.
Okay.
That'll be a good one to start with.
I didn't want to put you on the spot. I
didn't know. That's if you okay. Had that we'll one just jump right into it.
Yeah. Thank you. This is Weekend Let's Hear It. We are in WMUK's Takeda studio, and that was Dan Willenberg playing his rendition of Thelonious Monk's Round Midnight. And I'm sure Monk would have been proud. There were a lot of styles going on there, and it was interesting to see how you juxtaposed, you know, the fluid lines of the melody with a completely different groove in the middle and some angular stuff and some interesting harmonies.
Yeah, you know, to me it's kind of interesting. Everybody thinks of that tune as always a ballad. And to me it doesn't really have that. I mean, it obviously he played it as a ballad sometimes, but I always kind of feel that it's a little underappreciated as I don't know what to call it, but it's as a not ballad, you know. Everybody thinks it's this slow, kind of draggy, kind of, you know, really sad tune. But when Monk played it, it was always just, you know, it had, everything he played had so much joy in it, it felt like to me. And his rhythm to me kind of speaks the joy, you know. So I guess when I played that, I kind of tried to maybe capture that a little bit. I don't know if it was successful or not, yeah. But...
When you're playing someone else's tunes, how often is it appropriate, or how often do you want to channel and pay homage to that person and their music?
Oh, you know, that's a great question.
You said he originally played it as a ballad, and you know, you certainly don't have to, and you didn't. So I wondered how you navigated the waters of paying respect but still doing your own thing.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a good question. I think Monk is so unique as a pianist and as a composer. It's almost everybody who plays his music, it's almost like you sound like him it sounds like you're doing like a caricature of him, like you're doing like an impression of him. The thing about that is that that's what his music is, that his music requires that. You know, you can't play Monk tunes without having a Monk sound. Mm. So as far as, you know, paying homage to his tune in his style of playing his tune, it's kind of like built in, like you can't separate one from the other, which is the challenge, you know, because you don't want to sound like you're just doing a bad impression of Monk. You know, it's so easy to kind of fall into that. Like, okay, I'm going to play a Monk tune, so I'm going to do a bunch of weird stuff. I'm guilty of that too. I mean, it happens, you know, but once I kind of really got into his music, I learned that it's such an innate part of his sound. All of these kind of strange, you know, voice leading concepts that he would kind of imply. And it was, it would just kind of blew my mind to think for a second, like, it's okay to sound like Monk because, you know, Monk's tunes are Monk's sound. So if you're going to play his tune, you've got to have that in your vocabulary a little bit, you know.
One of the last notes that you played, just laid into it, and it was harsh and biting and just really jumped out among the texture, and that's certainly
I got that from him for sure. He was just, you know, he was unafraid. That's what I love about him the most. He just would do his thing, and he didn't care what the critics thought. He didn't care what the record companies thought. He cared what musicians thought. And you know, it's not like he didn't want to sell records, so he didn't care about his audience. I mean, he did, but he just knew. I think he saw further ahead than most people. You know, and so he knew that they would maybe come around eventually, but he never actually, you know, to a certain extent, you could argue that he never really got to reap what he sowed until later in his life when he became, a star as we know it now. But unfortunately, at that time in his life, he was kind of too far in seclusion, I suppose, to kind of truly reap the benefits of that, you know.
Yeah, you know, Monk is known as a bebop musician and one of the forefathers of that movement. And you have Charlie Parker and, you know, Dizzy Gillespie going a completely different route with playing these extremely busy melodic lines with all these notes, and you know, you have Monk at roughly the same time doing something completely different. And it's to me really, really interesting how these two different styles can exist at the same time.
Absolutely.
And, do you think it wasn't appreciated at the time because you know, the bebop purist didn't see it fit that he was playing that way, or
I think that right around when Monk was kind of getting his feet wet as far as, you know, being professional, that was when it was mostly still the big band era, you know, so everybody was still digging, you know, the Duke Ellington Orchestra, and everybody was kind of expecting jazz to become more of that, right? And so Monk was, you know, super inspired by Duke Ellington and really checked him out as a pianist and as a composer, and could play, you know, most of, if not all of his tunes, even though there's like 1,000 of them. And I think that Monk saw kind of the, he saw the silence as more of a resource in music than maybe Charlie Parker or Dizzy Gillespie, because they, I don't want to say that they were doing two different things, because they were still kind of finding the upper extensions of a chord, and they were still trying to, you know, basically play the changes of popular music of the day, and then write, you know, all these crazy melodies over it. But I think that Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, this is just my opinion, but maybe they did more of the kind of technical finesse kind of side, the maybe like the showman side of, like, when you watch somebody perform and they're just, their hands are just like flying, or their instruments just like spewing out all of these notes, and it's just like a cascade of like, oh my God, what's happening? Monk was the other side of that, where he was, I mean, he could do that and he did, but it was very much, he used it as an effect, you know, to kind of contrast his whole idea of space and openness in the music, and kind of letting the gaps fill themselves with something by one of the musicians in the band, or nothing at all. And that's okay. You know, but Dizzy, and I should say that Dizzy and Bird, Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker, respectively, they, you know, like any interview that they were asked about what they were doing in music or something, like, they always brought up Monk. Like, Monk was one of their, they championed him for a really long time, but it's kind of funny because he never really had the same kind of spotlight as like these two darlings of, you know, jazz at the time. And so, I mean, Monk, he knew that he was doing something special. I don't think that he necessarily like cared about having all this credit for like being the, you know, the high priest of bebop, but I think that it speaks volumes for knowing that Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, and, you know, even later on like Bud Powell, everybody just, the musicians were always talking about Monk, you know, while the general public or the whoever else was talking about all these other people, the musicians were like, you got to check out Monk, you know, they were the ones that came to hear him and wanted to learn from him.
So you talked earlier about the sparse style of his playing. Is that something that, it certainly wasn't in Dizzy's music or Charlie Parker. What about Ellington? Is that, that seems to me, in my general knowledge, of something that can be found a little more in Elling's compositional style, maybe not as soloistic playing, but.
Yeah, and absolutely. You know, another big reason for that is Count Basie too. You know, Count Basie and Duke Ellington both utilized the simplicity and silence, and you know, it's not about making simple things complex, it's about making complex things simple for them, and the less that you say sometimes, the more that you say. And I think I think that's one of the things that Monk definitely got from those guys, was just how to let the music be, you know, how to let silence be a tool for musicians. We often don't think about, you know, when we think about music, what is music? We think of, oh, it's sound that you know, sound waves that travel into your ears. And one of the things I teach my students all the time is that it's not only that, but it's the lack of sound. It's the opposite and the balance between the two. You know, when you go to a concert and everybody's quiet and then the musicians start playing, that's not because, I mean, yeah, it's polite, but also because when we perform, we want there to be silence and we want to create an experience for you from nothing. We want to build something for you. So that's why we'll sit and wait for you to be quiet until we're ready to, you know, to play. It's not because for some people maybe it's because they are so, you know, excuse me, I'm playing right now. But for me, I want you to hear silence first, and then I want you to hear what I have to add to it or what I can contrast that with.
Yeah, you start with a blank canvas that
exactly,
way.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, maybe since we talked about Ellington, and since he was such an influence of Monk, is there a tune that we could play that illustrates that?
Oh, yeah.
That you could play.
this is a beautiful, beautiful ballad, an actual ballad. This is called Prelude to a Kiss. And you'll hear a lot of chromaticism, which I think definitely Monk, I don't want to say he stole, we'll say he borrowed it from Duke.
You're listening to Weekend Let's Hear It and WMUK's Decatur Studio. I'm Craig Freeman, and we're here with Dan Willenberg, who just played a beautiful rendition of Prelude to a Kiss. And we were talking about the different influences, and that was a perfect example of that. And I could hear, in the left hand in particular, kind of a nod to the stride piano influence that that he has from James P. Johnson.
It's
cool to hear all these things just woven in the tunes that you play. That was really neat.
Thank you.
Speaking of his style, monk style, maybe we can talk about that for a little bit. What are some of the main characteristics of that? We talked about the chromaticism, generally being percussive, lots of syncopation.
As far as rhythm is concerned, I think that's, personally for me, rhythm is his first and foremost kind of like godlike quality. He can like turn the beat around in such a perfect way and make you feel like, wait, what's happening for a minute? And then he lets you know that he never left. He was always there, but you weren't there. And you missed it, you know? He would play. He had this way of taking the melody of a tune, and whether it was his tune or somebody else's tune, and he would always, he would never stray from it, but he would take he would push it to the limit of how far can you go away, but still be there, you know? And, you know, he'd put the melody somewhere else. He'd use it in an inner voice, and he'd be soloing with his right hand while the melody's going on, you know, somewhere. I don't even know. Maybe he had three hands sometimes, it sounds like, but it's always there. And he's always creating his solos around that very simple framework of the melody of the tune, which is, you know, for a jazz musician, it's so tempting when we play a tune. It's like you get to, let's say you're playing a tune that's 32 bars. When you get to measure 33, you immediately think, okay, phew, like now I get to do whatever I want now that the melody's out of the way. And for us, the challenge becomes, how do you still retain your own identity as an artist and as an improviser, but pay homage to or let the audience know or let yourself know that you're still playing a song, you know, or a piece or a tune or whatever you want to call it. And I think that true artistry to me, and this is, you know, it's totally subjective, but I think that when you can hear somebody taking the framework and not just going outside of it just because you can, you know, it's a mature approach to playing when you say, I have this melody of a tune and I want the melody. The melody is the most important part of a tune. That's what makes the tune a tune. It's not the chord changes, it ain't the rhythm, it's the melody. And so if you can stick with that, which Monk always did, you know, that was like he would tell a whole story using the same melody over, you know, six or eight choruses of a blues or something, you know, and you're just sitting there listening, and you can, if you're paying attention, see that, you know, he would play all this stuff and people would kind of get lost in like the, you know, the whoa, ugh, what was that? But he always, when you go back and listen to his recordings, you can, if you like sing along with the melody as you listen to his solo, you hear that, like if there's a, for example, if there's a, like in a tune called Baya, there's like this heavy kind of like downbeat thing that's going on, or that actually a better one would be the tune Evidence, how it has like all these upbeats happening. And when you listen to his solo over Evidence, every single time, almost, or maybe every single time, he would put his solo would have the exact same upbeat that's in the melody. No matter what he did there, there would always be something there, whether it's he's playing some run in his right hand, but you would hear the upbeat in the left hand, or maybe you would, he'd be playing stride and all of a sudden he would kind of bring the hands together on that upbeat, so that if you're paying attention closely, like that upbeat is always going to be there. And it's just fascinating because you really understand, I think, what was going on in his mind, as a composer. You know, his style of playing, I think, is a little bit more of, he was a composer first and a pianist second, and he played the piano as, you know, we often talk about jazz as like, you know, composing in real time, but that's really what he did. I mean, he never went away from that. It was like, he was always composing. Even when he's playing over a blues, he's creating some kind of, you know, framework of his own within this framework of his own. It's kind of wild.
I think of those, what are they called? Magic eye pictures, you know, it's like this kaleidoscope of weird colors and you have to get right up on the page.
Yes.
And then you like slowly pull back.
Exactly.
And then you can see, it's a horse or something.
Yeah. No, that's totally true. It's like the impressionistic side, you know, where the closer you are to something, the more blurry it kind of seems until, yeah, like you said, you kind of back away from it and you see, oh, that's what this is that I'm looking at, you know. Mm-hmm. But
maybe the chromaticism and all the those points that just jump out to the casual listener that didn't sound right.
Yeah.
Those are, you know, misnomers. Mm-hmm. And you're, as you say, missing the form, and it's always there.
Exactly. It's fantastic when because I think I used to listen to Monk and I used to just think like, wow, what a weird dude, you know, what a quirky kind of interesting sound for being, you know, for the sake of maybe being interesting. Right. And it's so much deeper than that. You know, the more that I play his music and the more that I learn about Monk as a human being, the more that I realize that his music and himself as a human being were not two different things. He wasn't just doing something because he could. He was doing something because he had to. You know, he believed in it so much, and he needed it to go that direction. He wouldn't have not gone in that direction. Mm. You know.
And he was, you know, notably, as you say, a quirky individual, and had some mental issues and dealt with that very publicly.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, you can hear that in his music. And how much do you think that hindered or helped him in a way in his compositional style?
That's a good question too. I tend to think of Beethoven and Monk kind of a lot in that whole side of, you know, the world of artistry. It's like you have this story of, you know, the starving artist, and it's kind of this, you know, melodramatic like idea of like, oh, we're just gonna like push through, you know. But when you look at their lives, and you know, Beethoven, for example, was a child prodigy at the piano. You know, he got really well known at, like, basically as soon as he moved to Vienna, and he kind of just like lit everyone up, and everyone was freaking out, and his compositional style kind of developed as a product of that. And he knew that he could push himself because people were going to be impressed at no matter what he did, kind of a thing, which opened up a whole new realm of possibilities for him. He was kind of building off of, you know, what his teacher Haydn kind of inspired, and Mozart as well. And as his deafness crept into his, I want to say like his life, but it's more than that. It's his, you know, his creative process or whatever you want to call it. He's, you know, how would we have had the Ninth Symphony if Beethoven wasn't deaf? Like that's mm-hmm. how I think about it, is if you can find a way to create something beautiful from something that isn't beautiful, from something tragic, I think that is probably, you know, speaks for the person even more than it speaks for the music. And I think that Monk was kind of the same way. You know, he never really received that kind of recognition, until a little bit later in his life, and he was always just kind of thought of as this weird, recluse who just was like so out like all the time and just doing weird stuff all the time. And I mean, to a certain degree he was, but like a certain degree we all do, you know? Yeah. And, so to compare them a little, you know, Beethoven and Monk a little bit more, is that there's this kind of understanding in the general public that like both of them were just like weird, crazy guys who maybe like drank way too much. And, you know, as far as Monk, like doing drugs and everything. And the more that you read about Beethoven and the more that you read about Monk, they both were just wonderful people that loved humanity and loved, you know, performing for charity events, for example, or for, you know, they loved getting together with friends and just like hanging out and being social and living life for what it was, even though they had all this other stuff going on. You know, they never let that ruin themselves as people, and they never let that ruin their music as a result of that. So yeah, I think that it's worth remembering that these kind of, you know, mythical ideas that we have about Beethoven or about Monk or whoever it is, it really doesn't always add up to what we kind of, this romanticized version of what we want it to be. So I think that their music is a result of that strength and overcoming that. And Monk is, I mean, even now, his music is still as, you know, I mean, Beethoven too. It's like we're still playing music from hundreds of years ago. And I, you know, maybe one day I'll have that kind of legacy. Maybe we all will, you know. Yeah. I hope that that I can have half of the, you know, inspiration or whatever you want to call it that they did.
Yeah, they were misunderstood, and it's a shame that it takes those moments of extreme brilliance, and it's, you know, it's a good thing they did compose that wonderful music that they did, because, you know, they really weren't understood, and they, I guess it's through that difficulty that they went through that they really were able to blossom.
And exactly,
it sounds kind of weird to say, but it's good that we did have that.
Yeah,
now we have that.
Yeah,
wonderful music to show for it. Speaking of music, would you like to play another tune for us?
Yeah, I'll play one that I thought of earlier. It's a tune called Baya, and it's kind of got a, Monk had this kind of, he grew up in San Juan Hill in Manhattan, and he was kind of always surrounded and inspired by Caribbean music, you know, with the clave rhythms and everything. And so this tune is, it's really got that vibe, and it's one of my favorite and most fun to play. So here is Baya.